The following is a presentation of the American College of Osteopathic Internists.
Welcome to this recording of the American College of Osteopathic Internists Internal Medicine Board Review Course. The course was held in Baltimore at the Marriott Waterfront Hotel on May 8th through 12th, 2019. The course featured nationally known speakers covering a wide variety of topics of importance to the internist preparing for initial certification or for recertification in the specialty of internal medicine. Disease of the colon is presented by Dr. Jack Bragg.
All right, diseases of the colon. This is by and large going to be probably more inflammatory bowel disease than anything, but there's some other things that we'll talk about as well that you need to know about prior to the boards. With IBD, keep in mind ulcerative colitis involves only the mucosa of the colon. Crohn's disease, on the other hand, is transmural, meaning it can involve everything through the wall of the GI tract to the serosa and can affect the GI tract from the mouth to the anus. And that's not just an academic point. When we start talking about the complications of these two diseases, this fact is going to be behind some of the complications that we see with Crohn's disease. So keep that in mind as we go through. Epidemiology, by and large, this is a disease of young people, late teens, early 20s. I practice in a college town, and there's more IBD patients from that age group than all the rest of them put together. It can occur at either end of the spectrum, though, the very young or the very old. The very young tend to have a more difficult course when it's diagnosed early. The elderly tend to have a easier course when it's diagnosed later in life than late teens and early 20s. But a patient's age will never guarantee for you that their symptoms are not inflammatory bowel disease. Smoking exacerbates Crohn's disease. It seems to protect against ulcerative colitis. Nobody knows why. There was a time several years ago when nicotine patches were the rage in order to treat Crohn's disease or ulcerative colitis. Ulcerative colitis. It didn't work. It caused people that weren't smokers to get all revved up on the nicotine and shake and sweat and have all kinds of symptoms. So nobody tolerated it very well, so it didn't go very far. Some distinguishing features between these two diseases: bleeding and tenesmus, much more common in ulcerative colitis than Crohn's. You can see it in Crohn's on occasion, but much more common in ulcerative colitis. In Crohn's disease, abdominal pain, perineal disease, and fistulas are much more common. The average time between the onset of symptoms in ulcerative colitis and the diagnosis is 7 days, because everybody gets excited about rectal bleeding. The difference in when Crohn's disease is diagnosed, the difference between the onset of symptoms and diagnosis is 6 weeks. Because most primary care doctors will chalk up abdominal pain, diarrhea, vomiting to a local flu bug that's going through the community or some other fairly benign process. Most people don't think about Crohn's disease when somebody comes in with diarrhea and belly pain. That is about half the patients you may see in one day in a primary care practice. So the time it takes to diagnose ulcerative colitis is much shorter than for Crohn's disease. Some distinguishing features, again, keep in mind the anatomy. Ulcerative colitis is limited to the colon and the mucosa of the colon. It is endoscopically continuous inflammation, and what that means is you'll see, as soon as you put the scope in, most of the time you'll see disease in the rectum and ulcerative colitis. There are about 5% of all people with ulcerative colitis that have a spared rectum. You put the scope in, you see disease, and it goes for a certain distance, and then all of a sudden it stops. There's a clear demarcation most of the time where the inflammation starts and where it stops with ulcerative colitis. Crohn's disease, on the other hand, it's discontinuous. The inflammation is, you may have disease, normal mucosa, disease, normal mucosa. You may have deep ulcerations with Crohn's disease that you typically don't see in ulcerative colitis. Ulcerative colitis unless it's pancolitis or covers the entire colon, usually starts in the rectum and works its way around counterclockwise of the colon. Crohn's disease is the opposite. Crohn's disease, unless you've got Crohn's colitis, Crohn's disease generally starts in the right colon and works its way around clockwise to the left colon. Mucosal involvement only with UC, focal inflammation with Crohn's. One of the other points to keep in mind, Crohn's disease is the only one of these two that you're usually going to see granulomas with, and that's only about 30% of the time. So the pathologist may not be able to tell you whether this is ulcerative colitis or Crohn's disease unless he or she sees granulomas. And if they do, then they can tell you this is most likely Crohn's disease. Here's the other point from this slide to remember, and that is indeterminate colitis. Oftentimes we can tell a patient, yes, you do have inflammatory bowel disease. There's not much doubt in my mind, but I cannot tell you at the present time whether this is ulcerative colitis or Crohn's disease. And in one sense, it doesn't matter because the treatment's going to be very similar for both. When it does start to matter is when the patient becomes a surgical candidate. And the surgeon always wants to know prior to surgery whether they're taking the colon out of a patient with Crohn's disease or ulcerative colitis because it makes a difference in the way they do the surgery. How do you diagnose it? Endoscopically with biopsies and ulcerative colitis, you see loss of vascular markings, diffuse erythema, exudate, and hemorrhage. Here's what it looks like. Mild case on the left and a severe case on the right. Obviously, on the right side, you see exudate, you see edema, you don't see any vascular markings. This is a very diseased and abnormal looking colon. Crohn's disease clinical features: chronic abdominal pain, far and away number one, diarrhea, perineal disease, distension of the abdomen, weight loss, fever, occasionally rectal bleeding, and in those of you that take care of kids, growth failure is a common trait with Crohn's disease. Other clinical signs in Crohn's disease: small bowel obstruction, appendicitis. It's not unusual to have a youngster come to the emergency room, has right lower quadrant pain, fever, vomiting. Surgeon takes him to the OR and opens him up and finds a mass of fat that's conglomerated together and a normal appendix. And that's the way the diagnosis of Crohn's disease is made in some people, especially youngsters. Fistulas between two diseased parts of the gut. Now here's where the slide on the transmural inflammation is important. You don't get fistulas most of the time in ulcerative colitis. You do in Crohn's disease because the disease is transmural. It goes all the way through the wall of the GI tract, and anything it touches, it may form a fistula with. It can form a fistula with other gut. It can form a fistula with the skin. It can form a fistula with the vagina or the bladder. It can form a fistula with a kidney or a ureter. Any place diseased gut touches with Crohn's disease, a fistula can form. And it's the same with abscesses. You don't see a lot of pelvic or psoas abscesses with ulcerative colitis. You will on rare occasions. But in Crohn's disease, they're not at all uncommon because that diseased gut is diseased all the way through the wall, and it will cause an abscess from time to time, either in the pelvis or behind the psoas muscle. Gallstones are more common in Crohn's disease because the terminal ileum is affected and you don't reabsorb bile. Kidney stones, same situation. The diseased gut prevents reabsorption of some things that it normally absorbs. And steatorrhea, fat in the stool, again because of diseased small bowel. Those are all much more common in Crohn's. Toxic megacolon. This is a problem that you see more often in ulcerative colitis, but you may see it occasionally in Crohn's colitis, and here's what it looks like. You'll notice this is the transverse colon that you're seeing here. Notice how thick the wall is here. That's distinctly unusual. Now you can see a toxic megacolon. Here's the thickened wall here. The sigmoid shape of the transverse colon is what's the most typical. You can see toxic megacolon involving other parts of the colon, but this is far and away the most common. So if you're asked about a patient that comes in with belly pain, distended abdomen, patient with known ulcerative colitis, the ER doctor gets this x-ray, and the question is, what do you do now? The correct answer would be call the surgeon, because this becomes a surgical emergency. You should be following this patient if they're very ill. If they're ill enough to be in the hospital, you should be following them clinically and with an occasional x-ray just to make sure this doesn't happen. How often do you get an x-ray? That's a judgment call. It's when you have to be a doctor. If you start treating them and they get better, toxic megacolon's probably not a risk. But if you start IV steroids, you start to treat them, you get surgery on board, they don't get better, belly gets worse, bowel sounds diminish, you'll be getting an x-ray as often as every day to make sure that this doesn't happen. And if it does, that you're on top of it. Extraintestinal manifestations. These occur probably in Crohn's disease more often than ulcerative colitis, and they occur about 10% of the time in your patients with IBD. I used to have to say we don't have any idea what causes these, but at least in the case of joints, it's been demonstrated that if you aspirate the joint of a patient with IBD that has joint pain, there are inflammatory cells in the joint itself. Now, the joints in these folks tend to not be red or swollen. They look like anybody else's joints, but the pain can be extraordinarily severe. I've had patients who had pain that was resistant to fentanyl patches. It was so bad. And, you know, if you have one like that, you think, well, maybe a drug seeker. But it happens more than once. And when it does, it makes you realize the joint pain can be really bad, even though these joints don't look like rheumatoid arthritis or anything like that. They look normal most of the time, but they can be very painful. And occasionally you'll have a patient who goes to surgery and has their colon resected, but they continue with their joint pain, and they have to continue with the infliximab or whatever you started them on to control their joint pain. The skin, I'll show you some pictures of pyoderma and I think erythema nodosum. The eyes, don't see too many eye problems. You can have scleritis or you can have uveitis. Uveitis is an ophthalmologic emergency. You want to refer them right away for a slit lamp evaluation. The liver, you can get anything in the liver from some mild elevation of the liver function studies all the way to PSC, sclerosing cholangitis, or anything in between. And thromboembolic phenomenon. This comes into play when the IBD patient comes into the hospital most of the time and they're flat on their back for a period of time. They need DVT prophylaxis because they're hypercoagulable and nobody's quite sure if that's because of the inflammatory process going on in the gut that is influencing the coagulation of the blood or exactly what it is. But if they're in the hospital, make sure you're doing something for DVT prophylaxis, even if just getting them out of bed several times a day and having them walk, that's better than nothing. Here's what pyoderma looks like on the right and erythema nodosum on the left. Erythema nodosum especially is not pathognomonic for inflammatory bowel disease. You can see erythema nodosum in several different settings. Pyoderma, if indeed that's what it is pretty much exclusive to ulcerative colitis. You have to have your dermatologist do a biopsy to make sure it's not sweet syndrome or something like that. But usually these open sores break out on the anterior aspect of the lower extremities. Most of the time they're not painful. It looks like it ought to hurt terribly. It looks like they should be in excruciating pain, but usually they're not. They just noticed that they had this open sore that's not getting any better. Ulcerative colitis and colorectal cancer, they tend to be, and we think that chronic inflammation is what causes the higher occurrence of colorectal cancer in UC patients. And we've noticed in the last few years with the drugs, specifically the biologics, we're seeing less colon cancer in our patients with inflammatory bowel disease, which is a good thing. But the malignancy tends to be in multiple sites. That's why we do a colectomy rather than take out a segment of the colon. It arises from flat mucosa, tends to not be associated with polyps like other forms of colorectal cancer. It infiltrates broadly. It's uniformly distributed. It's anaplastic, and it occurs at a younger age. So if you have a patient that's 18 years old, they have had pan-ulcerative colitis for 10 years, and especially if it hasn't been well controlled, if they've struggled with it, that 18-year-old kid is at higher risk for colorectal cancer, and you have to start screening them with endoscopy. There's controversy in the GI literature right now about chromoendoscopy versus high definition. Right now, most people believe that chromo may be a little bit better, but you're still okay if you're doing high def endoscopy and evaluating these people every year for dysplasia and colorectal cancer. Systemic complications, peripheral arthritis, I won't go through that list. You can do that. It's completely different though from the way rheumatoid arthritis or osteoarthritis affects the joints. Indications for surgery, well, exsanguinating hemorrhage, of course, that's an indication. Toxic megacolon and or perforation of the colon. Suspected cancer, significant dysplasia, growth retardation in a youngster, systemic complications of any kind, sepsis, one of those types of things, or intractability. We don't have medical intractability near as much as we did 20 years ago. The drugs are a lot better, but they're not perfect. We still need better drugs than what we've got. I probably used to send 2, maybe 3 patients a year to surgery for medical intractability. That's just as recently as 4 years ago. And intestinal complications with Crohn's disease, fistulas, I mentioned these a while ago. You can have a fistula just nearly any place. And so usually what happens is the patient comes in complaining of increased pain, sometimes fever, and knowing that it's a Crohn's patient, the first test you're probably going to do after a physical exam is a CT scan of the abdomen, look for that fistula, or an MRI. MRI is good for that as well. Endoscopic appearances, look, you can tell there's a difference between that and what I told you about ulcerative colitis, and here's what I mean by that. You get normal mucosa, abnormal mucosa, normal mucosa, abnormal mucosa. It's not uniform as in the case of ulcerative colitis. Crohn's disease, X-ray. On the left you see ileitis, and here's where the ileitis is here. This is the terminal ileum. It's diseased, but it's not stenotic and obstructed. If you see an X-ray like this, here's the terminal ileum in this patient. That's called a string sign because it looks like there's just a string of lumen left there. Here's the cecum. This is a small bowel, and this is the terminal ileum. String sign usually means it's a surgical problem. They usually have to have that resected, although if they're not completely obstructed and you want to try medical therapy for a couple of days, you can do that. But when the disease is this bad, they're probably going to have that terminal ileum resected. Ethnic and racial incidence tends to be, and this is all genetic, tends to be much more common in Jewish patients than it does non-Jewish Caucasians, and tends to be less common in African Americans for some reason. Again, it all goes back to who your parents are and affects the Northern European, I forgot, people from Northern European heritage tend to have this more than anybody else, and that oftentimes includes your Jewish patients. Management with the drugs is an entire lecture in itself. You probably are familiar with most of these. 5-prime ASA is still the drug of choice for ulcerative colitis, and budesonide is still the drug of choice for disease of Crohn's disease, especially if the terminal ileum and right colon are involved. All of these have a place, especially the biologics. Again, it's difficult to be able to give you much information on this. There are a group of patients who should receive myalgics right off the bat. And these are the folks that are extremely ill. It's called, well, the old way we did things, we'd start off with 5' ASA, then we might add azathioprine, then maybe steroids, and then finally biologics. That's called step-up therapy. There's a group of people, though, that are very ill that you're going to waste a lot of time and they're going to get more ill if you do it that way. And so you should start off with a biologic, infliximab, adalimumab, one of those in that group of folks. With people that just have proctitis, don't forget mesalamine enemas, mesalamine suppositories, in addition to oral 5' ASA. We use the two together. It's not overkill. You don't get a toxic reaction, but they get better faster. It's been demonstrated if you use 5' ASA enemas or suppositories and oral treatment. Now, if they have a mild case of proctitis, they're not that sick, I probably wouldn't use both. I'd probably just use the suppositories. They're going to get better if it's mild, but if it's very severe, they need both. This is sulfasalazine. Some of you that haven't been practicing too long may not even know what this drug is. It was the first drug we had for inflammatory bowel disease, and actually the rheumatologists discovered it for us. They noticed that their patients they were treating who not only had bad joints but had bloody diarrhea, the joints and the diarrhea got better. So it's an old drug. It works only in the colon, and that's because bacteria split this molecule where you see the NHSO2 part of the molecule. Bacteria split that in the colon, and the sulfa moiety gets absorbed and causes side effects, and the 5' ASA stays in the colon and treats the inflammatory bowel disease. All in the world that 5' ASA is, or mesalamine, is the 5' ASA that you see here on the slide attached to an inert molecule to make sure it gets through the stomach, the small bowel, and into the colon. Drugs are the same for both groups of patients, ulcerative colitis and Crohn's disease. The only significant difference is you'll use budesonide or Intercort on your patients with disease in the terminal ileum that have Crohn's disease, but you don't have that need in patients with ulcerative colitis. They don't get disease in the terminal ileum. But there is a budesonide for patients with UC that affects only the colon and not the terminal ileum. But remember what I said a while ago, 5' ASA is still the drug of choice for ulcerative colitis. Budesonide or Intercort is still the initial drug of choice for Crohn's disease. It's like everything else, nothing's 100%. It depends on the clinical situation, but those are good general rules to remember. When do you use azathioprine? Well, you can see the list here. Azathioprine or 6-MP, not the best drug in the world, not the most effective. It is inexpensive, and it is always used to augment either 5' ASA or budesonide. Or if you've got somebody on steroids and you can't get them off, azathioprine or 6-MP is a good choice to see if you can get them off of the steroids. Alpha tumor necrosis factor, this is the latest addition to our armamentarium for inflammatory bowel disease. I think there are 6 or 7 of them now. There's two different varieties, or actually, There's 6 or 7 biologics. The first group that we've had for a long time, infliximab, adalimumab, golimumab, that group, oppose alpha tumor necrosis factor. The others, nazolidimab and vedolizumab, prevent egress of white cells out of the bloodstream into the tissues. So the biologics are of a couple of different varieties. They work different ways. Here you can see, you don't have to remember this. This just shows you how these drugs work and where they work on the inflammatory cascade. Infliximab, first one that we had, the ACCENT 1 and 2 trials demonstrated that it works. And after infliximab, adalimumab was ordered. And as I mentioned earlier, there are a whole host of these biologics that we have available to us now, and they all work fairly well. transitioning to diarrhea. Diarrhea is both a sign and a symptom. As a symptom, increased frequency, volume, and decreased consistency is what patients will complain of. As a sign, stool weight greater than 150 to 200 grams for 24 hours. Stool water, the same, greater than 150 cc's to 200 cc's per 24 hours. Now, what's the point of this when you usually can understand what a patient says when they're telling you they're having diarrhea? They usually mean either liquid stools or more frequent stools. One reason you need to know is because there's a way to discriminate between loose stools or soft stools in a patient that has irritable bowel syndrome versus a patient that has an infection or Crohn's disease. And the way you do that is measure a 24-hour stool collection. Now, nobody likes doing that. Nobody likes putting stool in the refrigerator, and the nurses don't like you in the hospital if you ask for a 24-hour stool collection because it's difficult to do, but it will give you a lot of information. Now, you can order other tests on it, like electrolytes, various other things when you get a 24-hour stool collection. But this is the best way to find out if your patient, if you're not sure, if you don't know what's going on, I can't tell if this guy has a functional GI disease with diarrhea or if he's actually got some kind of pathology going on. So to collect a 24-hour stool and find out how much there is an excellent way to determine exactly what's going on with somebody. Again, we don't do it often because it's difficult, but it can be very helpful. History is important too. Has your patient been out of the country? What's the duration? Have they had this for months, or did this start last weekend? What medicines are they on? Did one of your partners put them on a penicillin drug last week, or metformin? What's their age? If they're 75 years old, think about microscopic colitis. If they're 3, think about a virus of some sort. What's their diet consist of? Do they eat a regular diet? Are they vegetarian? Are they an individual that eats nuts and berries and tree bark or something like that, some kind of off-the-wall diet? That can play a big role, too, in whether or not they're having diarrhea. What's the character? Frequency? Volume? Is there bleeding? Anybody with bloody diarrhea deserves a colonoscopy. Because even though it may be somebody that's fairly young and you think, well, this is probably hemorrhoids, you can't be sure until you look. My daughter's 35 years old. She had a classmate in high school, same age, who was diagnosed 2 weeks ago with metastatic colon carcinoma. He's got a hit in the liver as well as a sigmoid lesion, 35 years old. Most of the time, most people would not refer somebody like that for colonoscopy. They would assume it's hemorrhoids and treat accordingly. But you can't assume that. Fever, weight loss, anorexia, nausea, vomiting, dehydration, those are all what we call alarm signs or red flags. That patient needs a workup. If they've had non-bloody diarrhea and it's been not nocturnal, or in other words, just through the day, and no fever, none of these particular signs, and there's a flu bug going through the neighborhood, through the community, yes, you're probably dealing with the flu. You don't have to scope that person. It requires clinical judgment. Features of diarrhea that provide clues to the process, you should be familiar with these and know how to use them and when. I won't spend any more time on them since I'm about out of time. Chronic and recurring diarrhea should be investigated after your H&P. Check a stool for bugs, bacteria, enteric pathogens, Giardia, O&P. Endoscopic examination, as I mentioned a while ago, for the older folks who may have microscopic colitis. Lower GI bleeding. The most common cause of lower GI bleeding is going to be diverticulosis. AVMs are the other thing we see oftentimes, especially in the older group, but you can see a wide variety of things. There's all kinds of things you can do to check out lower GI bleeding, but obviously colonoscopy is the best because you can also treat while you're in there as well as diagnose. But you do have some other options in case a patient won't do endoscopy. If it's massive, you resuscitate them with IV fluids. You probably are going to call your favorite interventional radiologist and use use some type of invasive control with an arterial catheterization to embolize the particular bleeder. This is a diverticulum that's bleeding. You don't see them very often this way endoscopically. You do on occasion. This is a scan, a liver spleen scan, and right here there's a leak. This is probably in the cecum. If you've got a bleed that's steady but it's not overwhelming, a scan like this is another option that you have. Anatomical view of what causes diverticulosis. There's a narrowing or a weak spot between the musculature of the colon. This is an AVM. It's not bleeding right now, but they do bleed from time to time. Usually you find them in the right colon. This is radiation proctitis, difficult to treat. Fortunately, nobody ever bleeds to death from radiation proctitis, or they don't most of the time, but it can be tough to treat. Another spleen scan, liver spleen scan, the cecum is lighting up there on the right side. Microscopic colitis, we talked about this a little bit. Collagenous and lymphocytic colitis tends to be in older females. There may be drugs involved that cause it. Usually treatable with either bismuth or budesonide, one of the two. These last few, I'll just run through them. Pneumatosis coli, otherwise known as pneumatosis cystoides intestinalis. This is another one of those things you'll see once in a career, probably. Multiple gas-filled cysts in the submucosa of the gut. There's what it looks like on lower GI x-ray. I can't get anybody at the university to do a lower GI x-ray anymore. They want to do colonography instead. This is what it looks like grossly. Colitis cystica profunda, another similar type of disease, mucin-filled cysts in the submucosa of the bowel, three different patterns associated with it, and can be associated with IBD, so it's worth talking about. Most of you probably had patients with endometriosis that had GI involvement. Usually it's in the rectosigmoid area, and oftentimes you can see it endoscopically. If they're causing rectal bleeding, then you certainly can. SRUS, disorder of evacuation. This is something you may see in the nursing home more than any place else. It's caused from chronic constipation. The pressure of the stool against the wall of the rectum causes an ulcer is basically what it amounts to.